Hey guys, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Kristen. My sobriety date is August 24, 2006. I have a sponsor. Her name's Laura. I sponsor other women and they sponsor other women. I have service commitments with an Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm nervous. I just need to tell you guys. There's just something about me letting you guys know that I'm nervous that takes it away. So, I was born here in Florida. I was born in 1971 in Winter Park. You guys can do the math and figure out how old I am. And I was born to, mom and dad. But they were very young. And I look back now and I'm like, my mom was 19 and my dad was 21 when they got married. And I look back and I'm like, that is so young. And I was born when my mom was 21 years old and my dad left when I was less than a year old, and that relationship and that time has been a big part of my life, and I didn't know it. Through some work with the steps, you know, I was able to see that. And my biological father told me years later that he left because he didn't want to be a father and a husband anymore, and he also told me that he was a drug addict and an alcoholic, which that was the exact same scenario that played out in my life later on. Once I, towards the end of what I was doing and once I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So my mom marries this man, and I call him my dad. He's my dad that I call dad. He's the one that raised me. He adopted me. They had my brother. And it's so funny how, in hindsight now, I can see a lot of things, but my brother was my first resentment, and I was 5 years old, 5 and a half years old when he was born. And I say that because that was the first time that I remember trying to control a situation that did not come out the way that I wanted it to, and I was devastated. And I wanted him to be born a girl. I had his name planned out. It was Kelly. We were going to be best friends, and we were going to dress up, and we were going to go do girly stuff, and life was going to be great. And this is how it was going to go down, and it didn't. And I remember being picked up from kindergarten, and my neighbor picked me up, and she's like all excited to tell me that my baby brother, Philip, had been born. And I was just devastated, you know. And I used to dress him up as a little girl and put bracelets on him, and we have pictures to prove it. He actually showed him at his wedding. But, you know, that was at 5 years old, you know. I don't know what I believe. You know, I don't know if I believe that I carry this gene that science can prove or what. You know, I just know today that when I put anything mood or mind altering in my body, it changes the way that I feel. And I know today that I am powerless over alcohol and other things. So growing up, I grew up in that Nancy Reagan era, just say no to drugs. And in middle school, they had this big thing surrounded by Eric Clapton's cocaine song. And I can just remember in middle school thinking drugs are so bad. People that do them are losers, and drinking's bad. And, you know, there's no way that I would ever, ever end up like these mad. It was mad. What is it? Mothers Against Drunk Driving. They were doing this presentation. And there was no way that I was going to end up, you know, like that. And that was in middle school. And so, you know, progressing on, my parents, you know, they were the best parents that they could be. You know, I will say that I don't remember. Now, my parents may have a completely different story than what I tell when I speak, but I don't really remember any I love yous. I don't really remember, you know, any affection as far as hugs. My dad, he worked and he went to college full time, which is pretty much what I'm doing now, and he wasn't home a lot, you know, but I see now that he was trying to do the best that he could for his family because he didn't have a lot of things growing up, and he wanted to provide for his family. And so, you know, we didn't really have, you know, the nightly dinners or anything like that. I was not abused at all, you know, within my family. And they were, you know, good parents. I have a great relationship with my dad today, and it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom, she's still on my resentment list, but I try to show up and be the best daughter that I can be. So I took my first drink, and I've thought about this throughout the years. I think I was 14. I was either 13 or 14. I took my first drink for good behavior, or as a result of being on a cruise ship for good behavior, because I had just gotten out of my first treatment center. It was Horizon Hospital over in Clearwater. It's now called Winmore. And I went in there because I tried to kill myself. And I got out. It's funny, I just had to get my high school transcripts. So I was 14, yeah. I had to get my high school transcripts a few semesters ago for college. And I earned a credit when I was in this little rehab. It was kind of funny to me. I thought it was pretty amusing that I earned a credit in a little treatment rehab for juvenile delinquents. And so I went, I was in on this cruise ship with my cousin. She's 4 months older than me, and my grandmother took us. And we had our own cabin, and out in international waters, the drinking age is 18. I guess the guy thought we were 18, or he was just serving us. But I remember it, you know. I can't tell you, like, you know, the first time, like, I had a glass of Coke or pizza or, you know, steak. But I can tell you the first time I took a drink, and I remember exactly what the glass looked like. It was a tall glass, and it had, like, the little bubbles on the bottom. It was such a little pretty glass. And it was a pina colada. And I do not remember it changing the way that I felt. I know I hear that in stories a lot of the times. I don't remember that. I do know that we met some boys, which is another thing that I always use. Drugs, alcohol, and men. I know that we are in Alcoholics Anonymous, so I will keep to my alcoholism. But I, in the big book, in my big book, it says that I cannot safely use alcohol in any form, in the doctor's opinion. And drugs for me are alcohol in any other form, and so are men. Because I was always trying to fill some sort of, you know, fill something that's missing within me. And those three things did it. And if I had all three at the same time, it was even better. So I'm on this cruise ship, and we meet some boys, and we go play quarters with them. You know, and we're drinking a little bit on this cruise ship. And, you know, and then I got into some trouble and tried to kill myself. And I hopped around from different high schools. I went to four different high schools. So I really didn't establish any relationships really in high school, and that's how it was in elementary school too with my dad's job. We moved around quite a bit, and even as a young kid, Jennifer, I could totally relate. Like, you came up here and said a lot of my story. You know, even in elementary school, I just didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. You know, I wore glasses, I was called Four Eyes all the time. And I just felt less than. I didn't even feel like I fit in my own family, you know. And I just wanted to belong somewhere, but I didn't know it, you know. And I also, too, thought it was everybody else. You know, they just didn't understand me. And one thing that I really, and even to this day, from being young to now, I've always found there's something about music with me. You know, I can always identify and relate. And when I was younger, my parents gave me a boombox for Christmas, for those of you that know what that is. And I would go hide in the bushes and play my little eight-track cassette tape and listen to the radio. And I always wanted to be in those songs, if I'm explaining that right. I wanted to be, like, the scenario of the song or whatever they were singing, that's where my mind would escape to. And that also was at a young age. That was, you know, the elementary school and middle school. So I've got this resentment against my brother at 5 years old, and then even younger, you know, I'm trying to escape through music, you know, and throughout the years, even in early part of recovery, it was a lot of music and a lot of songs that I heard that really helped me pursue a relationship with a higher power, especially that Stevie Wonder song, Superstition. There's just that one line, you know, believe in things that you don't understand. And I lived on that line for a really long time. And sometimes I still can. So, you know, I have this drink and things are fine, and I'm hopping around to different high schools. And I actually, eventually, met some girls, and they came into my life when I was about 14, 15. We're still friends to this day. We've been friends for almost 30 years, and they've been huge, you know, huge supporters for me. So I go through high school, and I'm still on this Nancy Reagan kick from middle school, and I'm going to be the designated driver because all my friends are drinking, and drinking's bad, and, you know, don't do drugs and all that stuff. And I experimented with some weed in high school. When I was 19, my girlfriends got me a fake ID to go see Vanilla Ice that was playing over at the venue, and I was drinking before we got there, And before he came on stage, I guess I blacked out. I either blacked out or passed out. I think I passed out. And when I woke up, he was done. And I was so upset. Like, I blamed all of them for letting them, for letting me drink as much as I did. Because it was their fault that I drank and missed this guy on stage. And so, you know, and again, blaming everybody else. So, you know, fast forward, my parents are getting a divorce. I want to escape. So I escape up to New York and I get this really good job. And it was 20 minutes from the city. I had two blackouts there. I was not really, I don't think I had many blackouts because I unfortunately remember a lot of my drinking. And, you know, would wake up with that guilt, shame, and remorse that the big book talks about and the you know, the four horsemen. And so I did the whole geological cure thing and escaped to New York when I was like 20, 22 or 23 years old, right outside of the city. And it was a lot of fun. You know, my drinking, it was really fun in New York City. And so, you know, before I'd left, I'd met a guy, and his name's Mike, and I eventually married him. I was living in New York, and I called him one day, and I'm like, hey, I'm moving back, and we're going to move in together. And he's like, all right. So that's what I did. And then we got married, and a year later, my daughter Jordan was born. She was born in 1998, and my son Dylan was born, and he was born in 1997. So throughout this period of, like, my life from when I took my first drink up to in high school, like I said, I really didn't do much drinking, but I was drinking in my 20s because that's what I thought I was supposed to be doing. And I eventually, you know, turned 21, could get into a club legally. And, it was really easy back then. You know, you just get a fake ID that has blonde hair or whatever color my hair was at the time. And, you know, you could pretty much get alcohol or get in wherever you needed to go. And, you know, by this point, weed was the only thing that I had done. And so I get married, and I'm 26 or 27, I don't remember. We have these kids, and I have this great husband. And I did, you know, and by all outward appearances, my life should have been great. I had the great husband, the two beautiful children, you know, we had the house, the car, we had the dog, we just didn't have the white picket fence, and, like, everything should have been great, you know. And I knew, you know, I still had that feeling from childhood of just not fitting in and just not being okay. And I remember getting this magazine in the mail, and it was talking about having a quarter-life crisis at the age of 25. And I was a few years older, and I'm like, that's got to be it. Not, you know, not midlife crisis anymore. It's quarter-life crisis. I did the self-help book routine for a little while, you know, and I was always trying to look for something to, like, diagnose myself with. WebMD, that's my doctor, you know, and, but, you know, I was always trying to figure out what was wrong with me, and, you know, I did that early on in sobriety, too. So, you know, I'm gonna fast forward, like, a lot, because it's not really, I'm just say what happened to me, to maybe some of you guys can relate a little bit to it, I don't know, but, you know, recovery is where it's at, because we all know how to get drunk, that's why we're here, you know, I think, most of you. I will speak for you, but, you know, that's, I know how to do that stuff, you know, and we can all try to, you know, we all tell our stories and stuff, and some of us can relate, but anyway, I believe for me, it's the feelings that you guys have that are the same that I can relate to, you know, I can't, and I thought that, like, when I first came in, like, I had to one-up you guys with my stories, but it's those feelings, I think, you know, of feeling less than and the ego and the self-centeredness. So, you know, here comes 30. 30's rolling around, and it's the husband's the problem, the kids are the problem, and I do exactly to my ex-husband what my dad did to my mom, which was I did not want to be a mother, and I did not want to be a wife anymore. The husband and the kids were, you know, they were a pain. And, you know, I look back now, and I was afforded the opportunity to be able to stay home with my children, and not a lot of people are, you know, there needs to be two incomes in a house. And, you know, I'd give anything to have that time back with my kids. So the husband would come home, and, you know, I was off to the races. And as soon as he would leave, get home, I would bitch about, you know, the kids are driving me crazy, I need to get out. And so I would. We did not keep alcohol in the home. Like, I look back now, and I think maybe Mike knew, like, way ahead of me that I was an alcoholic, because he never really drank. You know, we didn't really keep alcohol in the house. People would bring alcohol over if we were, like, entertaining. So when he would come home, I would leave, and there was a little gas station right down the street from our house, and that was the first place I'd stop, man. I would get me a big old whatever, Michelob. I used to drink Bud Light bottle, so I'd get a big Bud Light, you know, and I sold Tupperware. I was a Tupperware lady at the time, and I had this really cool Tupperware cup that, like, you put a lid on it, you cannot smell anything, because this is my thinking. I'm going to be drinking and driving, and if there's a cop next to me, he might be able to smell it or see what I'm drinking, or if I get pulled over, I can just throw this really tight cap on my Tupperware and he won't smell the alcohol. Like, I planned my drinking and driving. And so, you know, I did that every time I went out just to get my night going, and then I'd go meet my girls who were not married, nor did they have children, and they could probably act any way they wanted to. But when I was out with them, I did not act like a married woman, and I did not act like a wife, and I was not faithful. I was not faithful to him for the majority of our relationship. And again, you know, looking for validation from somebody else. And I got it for about 20 minutes each time. So I would go, so we would go out, and when I turned 30, I left. And I had been in counseling. I got to say this. I have been... you know, I was diagnosed ADHD or ADD back, it was back then, at age 7, you know, and from 7 until I was 32 or 33 years old, I had been on some sort of medication because I was a chronically depressed and I was a hyperactive kid. And, you know, and throughout those years, I had seen, you know, been in and out of therapy sessions and psychiatrists and psychologists and all this stuff. So at age 30, I leave. Again, because I don't want to be a wife and a mom anymore, and I moved out on my own, and that is when there's a part in the big book that talks about crossing that line, you know, and I think I know when I crossed that line. I think it was when I moved out of my apartment. I had been drinking, and I was crawling across the floor, and I couldn't get drunk anymore. And I did the whole go to one store, get a case of beer, drink all that, and then go to another store and get a six pack to finish the night, you know. And you know, I would hide my alcohol, not from myself, but I would hide it in case other people came over, because I didn't want them to know how much alcohol I had. And you know, I would try to strategically, like, place these bottles in between toilet paper rolls and paper towel rolls, because I didn't want the bottles to clink when I was taking the garbage out, so that my neighbors in the other apartments could hear it. I mean, like, this thinking, during my drinking and using career, like, I had these little things where I had to hide what I was doing, and now I see, like, that was the insanity of my disease. So, you know, I meet a guy, and that's when I'm introduced to the IV alcohol, that form, and the opiate one, and man, that started it, you know, that sense of ease and comfort, you know, is what I had been looking for my entire life, and I chased that for so long, you know. I ended up in my first detox within, I think it was either like 6 to 9 months, I ended up in Operation Par, because I just needed to be physically detoxed, or so I thought. And I remember people coming in from Alcoholics Anonymous in another fellowship. I could not relate with the people from AA, because alcohol clearly was not my problem. It was this other stuff. And, you know, I could drink alcohol just fine. But what I found that I was doing is that when I was doing those other substances, I was just, alcohol was just put down for the moment. Alcohol was the first thing I picked up and the last thing I put down. It was very consistent in my life. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was one of the things that I was like, I felt like I'd lost my best friend. You know, because alcohol is socially acceptable. And I just can't, you know, I can't drink it safely. So it was very hard for me to see that I was powerless over alcohol, but I could see it with the other stuff. So I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for the other stuff because I don't know if I would have ever eventually realized that maybe I am an alcoholic. So, you know, I end up in some more treatment centers or detoxes or two more to detox from this other stuff and did the methadone thing for a little while. And, you know, I've been arrested. I've gotten a DUI. I've been in jail. I was on house arrest for 9 months. That sucks. I'm look back now. Another thing in hindsight, should have taken the 10 days in jail instead of the house arrest. But, you know, it happened the way that it did. And so how I ended up to Alcoholics Anonymous is I had, after one of those Operation Parsons, I heard get a sponsor and I heard work the steps. And the whole sponsor thing, I thought a sponsor was like what the NASCAR sponsors. And I'm like, I remember thinking in my head, well, Budweiser or Bush can't sponsor me because that's alcohol. Like, you know, again, that insane thinking. And I thought that, you know, I had to buy a sponsor. I had to pay a sponsor. I had no money, so I was not going to get a sponsor because it just wasn't going to work out. So I went to some meetings. And I went to a meeting for the sole purpose of going with this guy who I, rehab romance guy, who I met in rehab. And him and I were together off and on for a few years. When he was trying to get sober, I wasn't. When I was trying to get sober, he wasn't. He died from this disease the first month I was sober. And that really hit me hard. It really showed me that, you know, we die from this. So I go to this meeting and I hear this serenity prayer and I hear them talking about God and I'm in the wrong place because they're talking about God and this is a cult. So I'm just not even going to, I don't want anything to do with God. I was raised and confirmed a Lutheran and I really enjoyed my time and I didn't talk about this, but I really did enjoy my time in church. I belonged to a youth group. And this is another thing, too. Being confirmed meant that you could drink the blood of Christ, and the blood of Christ was wine. And I remember when I was like 12 and 13 years old after I'd been confirmed and could drink the blood of Christ, that I would go and look through our church bulletin for the month to make sure my parents took me to that service because it was wine that they were serving. And I didn't realize that, you know, and that was way before I took my first drink. Maybe that is my first drink. I don't know. But, you know, I do remember trying to search those out so that I could go get that wine. So I end up in this motel room on Clearwater Beach, and it's going to be condemned. And I was hanging out with people that were just like me. I was hanging out this one chick. She was into some import-export stuff, and I had a valid driver's license, and she did not. And so in order for me to get what I needed to get through the day, I was her little driver, and she would supply my things that I needed to get through the day to drive her around. And I remember this part is a really good reminder, and it's one that I often think about when I feel like sometimes, because I can get AA'd out sometimes. And this part is a really good reminder for me. But I would leave. I'd moved out of my apartment. The ex-husband let me back in. Why, I don't know. But he did. And by this time, I'd started to leave. And I would tell Mike I was going to get a pack of cigarettes or a loaf of bread. And I would leave. You know, I'd be gone for, you know, 2 weeks at a time. My cell phone had been turned off by then. And I would call him once in a while just to let him know that I was alive. And he told me that my son, Dylan, was asking his grandmother if his mom was dead. And that's a reminder of me of what this disease does. And so I would go on these little binges, and once in a while I'd show back up. I'd show back up in April one time for my daughter's birthday because I'm trying to be the good mom and show up. I show up in December on Christmas, and all I do is sleep. You know, I needed to be refueled. And, you know, I would go on these binges for days and be up for days. And so, man, all right, let me get on to recovery. Sorry. So I end up in AA eventually. I end up in AA, and I came here as a result of my last treatment, which was my first treatment. Then it was Horizon, and when I came to AA, it was one more. So I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I show up at Club 3333, and you guys are just crazy, because you're in there talking about God, and you're laughing, and you're having fun, and, I had gotten a sponsor, but she lived over in St. Pete. I do not remember this woman talking about God or spirituality. I just remember, like, working the steps. I was not honest with her at all. And so, you know, I continued to relapse. And I moved into a halfway house. It was Koala House. I was there, like, for about 2 years. I got kicked out of there because I had relapsed. I relapsed many, many times. And I was thinking about this the other day. I have my very first big book still, and I kept writing my sobriety dates in there, and every time I'd relapse, I'd scratch it out. So I looked at it, and it's like half a page that is just black, you know, blackened. And this time that I got sober, I never wrote my sobriety date in there because I kept thinking, and I remember thinking this, what's the use, you know? I'm just going to relapse anyways. And so I found for me that I believe this is my experience and my truth, is that I did not put action into it in the beginning. I was just showing up at meetings, and I would hear things like, keep coming back, meeting makers make it. That is not my experience, because I sat in meetings, and I did not get and stay sober just going to meetings. For me, I found that I needed to do some action, and it was a lot of painful emotional stuff that I did not want to look at. I did not want to call some woman I didn't know, and talk to her and tell her what was really going on. I have 15 minutes, huh? Man, I wanted to go through the steps. Okay, so step one, powerless and unmanageable. I didn't know that I was powerless over alcohol. Like I said, I knew the other things. But there's, on page 30, it says that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. And that's what it took for me. I had to concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. And I believe that to this day. If I put anything in my body, alcohol, whatever, you know, just one, I'm off, you know. And step two and step three has to do with my spirituality and my relationship with God. I struggled with that the first year that I came into recovery. My conception of a higher power has changed many, many, many times. I had the guy in the sky. I had the guy with the human characteristics. I wanted the burning bush thing. I didn't get it. I believe that mine has been what's in the back of the book about the spiritual experience, the educational variety. I have gotten to this place. I got very angry about a year ago at God, and I thought I was going to like relapse because I needed to be in some spiritual place that I thought I should be in. What was mentioned, thank God for sponsorship. You know, I've got to this place where I am completely 100% in this good place with my relationship with my higher power, and it is contingent on what I do on a daily basis. I cannot define my God to you anymore. I just know that I have a higher power. I don't understand my God, and I'm glad that I don't, because my ego will be off and thinking that if I understand my God, then, you know, I'm bigger than my God and I can control it. So, you know, four was an eye-opener for me because it showed me those things like my pride and my ego and my self-centeredness. And step four is a lot like my visits to my counselor and my psychiatrist for all of those years, because it was, you know, talking about me, you know, and how people pissed me off and all this stuff. But the one thing they didn't give me was my part, my character defects, and my truths about me. And so that was a big eye-opener for me. Six and seven, girl, I'm with you. I still work on it, you know. I had an experience when I was struggling with this God thing about a year ago that I had been through six and seven before. I'd been through the steps a few times. And I had to, like, humbly go to God. Like, I have never gone to God and practiced six and seven last year when I got in that space where I was being very angry with God. And it was just like being sober again. It was a very painful experience for me, and it lasted for a few months. And, I realized that I did that to myself, obviously. But it was like I got naked in front of God emotionally like I never had done before. And I hope I don't have to go through that again. But, that's six and seven. Eight and nine, I got to make amends to that biological father that I was never, ever, ever, ever going to make amends to. And when I made that amends, that was a huge amends for me. it opened up a lot of things for me emotionally. It opened up some trust issues I had been having with my husband. Well, he wasn't my husband then, but with men in general. It also opened up relationships with women for me and taught me to trust women a little bit more and open up to other women. And, you know, thank God for the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. They have saved my ass and carried me, and some of the men, too. 10, 11, and 12, that is what I attempt to do on a daily basis, continuing to take personal inventory. I would love to tell you guys I sit down every night and do a written 10-step inventory. I'd be lying. I do that when I get, you know, a little squirrely and crazy, but I do a lot of the spot check inventories, and I have this gauge, I guess, in my gut where I can tell that, you know, I may have stepped on somebody's toes. 11, thought through prayer and meditation. I read it as prayer for like the first 3 years, so that's all I was doing. Meditation is really important to me. I do my best to spend at least 3 minutes a day just quiet, you know, with my higher power. Again, I already explained, I do not understand God, but it's the way that I understand him today. 12. Step 12. For me, there's being of service and there's sponsorship. And, you know, Megan had talked about getting her 3 years, and I've been her sponsor for about 2 of those years. And one of the biggest gifts for me is to be able to watch women that I know on an intimate basis and watch them go through struggles in their life. And Megan's one that I have loved to watch grow in that area. You know, and, you know, she gets honest about things and she admits things. And it's really cool to see. I don't like it when they're in pain, but I get it, you know. And it's really cool to watch, you know, someone like Megan come through that, you know, and talk about when she's struggling and admitting that she doesn't have all the answers and that she might need to go to God and help others. But, you know, when I started sponsoring at 6 months sober, that's where my recovery, it changed the dynamic of my recovery. Because, you know, there's been some things in my life since I've been sober that have affected me greatly. And there were two different periods that, you know, the women that I sponsor showed up, you know, and other women did too. They carried me through that, and there's no way that I will ever be able to repay them. And there's two guys sitting in this room that they know who they are. And I was living in a halfway house, and it was the first time that I thought that I wanted to drink. It was the first time I picked up the phone to call somebody because I really wanted to drink, but I really wanted to stay sober. And so I call this person, and this person says, you know, don't drink for 10 minutes. Can you do that? I'll have somebody come pick you up. And sure as shit, 10 minutes later, somebody came and picked me up. And I stayed sober that day. And, you know, that's what people do. They show up for me. And I do my best to show up for other people. And but that step 12, man, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message and to practice these principles in all our affairs. That's what I try to do today, you know, is practice these principles. I don't do it perfectly, and I have to remind myself that it is progress, because I set the bar of expectation on myself so high, and God doesn't do that to me. I do. So the two most important things for me on this journey so far have been my relationship with my higher power and helping others. So I did not want to speak tonight. I never do. However, I appreciate you guys all being here and being sober. So thank you.